Welcome back to the Neuro Network. I'm Nick. I'm a neuroscientist and professor of comparative biosciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today's episode is a special one. I had the chance to sit down with Dr. Christoph Koch, one of the world's leading visionaries on consciousness, perception, and the neural basis of our inner lives. And what began as a conversation about the brain blossomed into an exploration of what it really means to be human. Dr. Koch is a neuroscientist known worldwide for his pioneering work on the biological basis of consciousness. His decades of work has helped shape modern theories of perception and awareness. He served as the chief scientist and president of the Allen Institute for Brain Science, where he remains as an investigator and as the chief scientist at the Tiny Blue Dot Foundation, where he continues to push the frontiers of how the brain generates subjective experience. Few people have thought as deeply or as fearlessly about how the brain gives rise to consciousness. We talk about consciousness in the sense of self, how the brain constructs a you that feels solid, yet is constantly changing. We dive into anxiety and fear and why the mind generates these states even when we're safe. We explore dreams, perception, the way psychedelics may temporarily reshape the boundaries of our identity. But this episode isn't just about neural circuits. It's about life. We wander into the terrain of exercise and mental clarity, confronting one's inner demons, and the lifelong practice of cultivating inner peace. We discuss why diverse experiences enrich the mind and why community matters more than we realize. We even talk about how the Amish can offer a surprising lens on human consciousness and connection. This conversation ranges from molecules to the meaning of life, from the deeply scientific to the deeply personal. So settle in. You're about to hear from an incredible scientist who has spent his career trying to understand not just how the brain works, but how we work. All right, let's jump into my conversation with Dr. Christoph Koch. All right, today we got Dr. Christoph Koch. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
Yeah, so I was telling you a little bit about before I was hosting a live version of this podcast for a few years. And one of the games that we had always played was, let's see how long it would take before the word consciousness came up in the questions from the audience. And I don't think we ever really made it past 3 or 4 minutes whenever you're talking about neuroscience. So needless to say, the world of consciousness or our conscious perception of the world is something that has always been of interest in the neuroscience community and the general science community and the public community. Why do we feel the way that we feel? And so I was glad to be able to have you join us on here because you spent many years trying to understand that at a level much deeper than many of us even knew that we could think about. And so what I wanted to do is to try to get a little bit of insight from you, Christoph. You know, how did you become interested in understanding the world of consciousness, and what was sort of the moment or a series of moments when you thought, all right, this is what I want to dedicate much of my life to understanding?
Well, first of all, I have to disagree with you. When I started thinking about this and working particularly with a very close colleague and collaborator, Francis Crick, you could not publicly muse about consciousness as a scientist.
Really? Oh,
I'm very serious. And I did this when I was Caltech. I hadn't even attained the holy state of tenure. And I'd had colleagues at Caltech who were sitting on my tenure committee take me aside and literally talk to me in a very friendly, collegial way, saying, well, Francis Crick, he's a half god. He can do whatever he wants. But you don't have tenure yet, and you have to be very careful talking about consciousness, because some of us consider it, you know, a topic not fit for science. So grad students who are typically attuned to the mores of the elders, they saw at the time start rolling their eyes when, no, okay, there he goes again on consciousness. So it's not true that it has always been an occupation of neuroscientists, which is surprising because we know, unlike previous culture, it's not the heart, it's the brain that sort of is the immediate physical substrate of consciousness. And what shocked me at the time in the late 80s, early 90s, how If science, I always felt very strongly, if science fails to explain how conscious experience comes into the world, the central aspect of my existence, right? How do we know that you, how do you know that you exist? How do I know that I exist? Only because I feel. I mean, this is the central insight of Descartes, cogito ergo sum. But it's not only thinking, it's also because I have pain, because I see, because I dream, because I imagine. Otherwise, if I'm unconscious, I have no knowledge that I exist. So I would find it shocking that scientists didn't put this at the center of their thinking.
Yeah, so perhaps it might be something to say that without a conscious experience, even having life itself isn't necessarily all that meaningful to us unless we are able to perceive it. So with consciousness, though, it is becoming, or it has been, a buzzword for a little while in both neuroscience and philosophy. And so from your aspect, how would you define consciousness? Because I think I've seen a lot of debates, or I've been in a lot of debates of consciousness, of trying to find brain mechanisms of it and things. But I don't know if there's ever been, usually when two people are arguing about a theory of consciousness, they don't agree on what their definition of consciousness is to begin with. And so how would you define consciousness itself?
Any experience, thinking, seeing, hearing, dreaming, dreading, imagining, any conscious experience whatsoever, being bored, eating, you know, tasting a slice of cold pizza, anything.
Anything. So the idea that you're feeling certain things, and so with the level
of behavior, you can dissociate this from behavior. Of course, very often you ask me, I mean, among people, particularly able-bodied adults, you ask them, how do you do? And you say, well, I'm depressed. I'm rather sad about the state of affairs in the world, right? So I try to infer through behavior, or you can point at things, you know, I see something over there. But you can do that without. You can sit on the cushion when you meditate for hours, you know, without batting an eyelid, literally. You can dream when your brain actively, you know, shuts down voluntary muscles, or you can be on a, you know, magic mushroom trips at a high dose where you're lying down, you know, you're totally immobile, but you're literally experiencing heaven and hell. So, and this is particularly important in the clinic, by the way. So some people only say, well, I can only study consciousness, no matter, even if they define it, well, these elusive feelings, they say, well, I can't study those. I can only study behavior associated with consciousness. But then we have to think about that. Okay, now I've just suddenly made this switch from feeling to behaviors associated with feeling. And that is not the same. They may relate, they do relate under certain condition, but not always. And you have to be aware that there is this switch going on, that you're not studying the real thing, you're studying a substitute of the real thing.
So it's almost like there's everything that we have to express the consciousness itself is a proxy measurement.
Yeah, this is what makes consciousness different. I mean, philosophers refer to it as a first person property. This is what we mean by subjective. Subjective really means it's only I directly access my feelings. You can put me in a scanner, right? You can read out, like Jack Allant has done at Berkeley. You can sort of begin to read out what I see in a very primitive, restrictive way, but you don't have my experience of what I see. And I can tell you I'm sad, but I could be totally faking it. And we spies do this. If you have an affair, you know, you might totally lie to your spouse that you still love her, but you know, she has no idea what's really going on. So yes, we always, this is what makes studying consciousness more challenging than studying black holes or viruses or pure third-person brain properties, like which neurons are firing, which parts of the brain are active, which genes are up or down regulated. But we can use those techniques to get very close to that.
All right, we're back in business. Little technical difficulty, but we got it figured out. All right, so we're talking about the idea of consciousness being a experience that is somewhat hindered by our ability to actually express what we mean by it. And so, you know, specifically in my lab with the world of neurophysiology, a lot of physiology things that we do, we're also trying to get a proxy measurement that closely approximates how a certain variable like the heart is functioning. without actually going in and perturbing it. You know, ideally, we'd have a catheter directly in the heart if we're trying to figure out how these neurons are controlling the or transcribing the function of the heart at a certain time, but we can't do that. And so we have to use sort of external measurements that get close to it. And so with the idea of consciousness and being perhaps hindered a little bit by our ability to have a quantifiable direct measure of it, do you think that going forward in advancing consciousness research, is it going to be a game of what are the newer tools that can be able to more closely approximate it? Or is there ever going to be a way to actually get an idea or an actual physical measurement of what consciousness is?
My gut feeling is no, but of course we don't know, particularly if it's true that consciousness, as many people argue, is a fundamental feature of the world. What I mean by that it doesn't emerge. I mean, what's the standard narrative that sort of neuroscientists have without much thinking about it? The standard narrative is, well, you have the Big Bang, you have evolution of stable stars and come, you know, stable planets, stable planetary environments. You get evolution going in a, you know, in a wet pond. You get little, bacteria, single cell organism. And then from those, you grow multicellular organism. And then you get, you know, the Cambrian explosion. You get creatures which have big brains, ever bigger brains. And at some point, they become conscious, and at some point in our case, they become self-conscious. In other words, they become aware of themselves and, you know, realize that they're, you know, that they're going to die one day, etc. That's a standard story. But of course, it may also be true that that's simply totally wrong and that it doesn't emerge in any sense of the world, of the word. Either it may always have been there, baked in the fundamental aspects of the universe, or that any complex system, even very simple systems, like in the limit, a single cell organism that after all, no one or no supercomputer has ever modeled all the, you know, hundreds of millions of proteins that occur in all the causal interaction that occur in a single paramecium. So according to some, it may well be that even a little paramecium feels a little bit like something. You know, clearly it doesn't have a voice in its head like you and I do. In fact, probably not even cats and dogs have voices in their head in the sense that you and I have, you know, because that does require a lot of physical superstructure. But it may well feel like something throughout the tree of life. And at this point, we simply don't know because we have this point of view, well, it's only in us. And then since, you know, Darwin, we accept grudgingly, well, maybe, you know, other mammals are also conscious, but most people leave it at that.
Well, that brings up an interesting thing. You mentioned the inner voice of ourselves that it has a big driver on our conscious experience. Now, I'm curious when it comes to that inner voice, and the reason I'm curious about it is I've had a couple different experiences competing in different sports, and then I promise this will make sense. When I started in sports, I was racing criteriums for cycling and then doing some triathlons. And I was on a scholarship for cross-country skiing for college. And so there was these endurance sports that I was mainly focused on. And one of the things that I loved when I was doing that was that inner voice was almost, yes, on, you know, superpowered because, you know, who knows, you had some adrenaline and some endorphins going. And so it was just sort of amplified that inner voice. And at that time, I was early in my academic career, and so all of these new concepts were fascinating. How does the body work? How do these brains work? What is this neuroplasticity? Things like that. And then as I progressed through sports, I had changed to more of the power, the explosive type of sports. So powerlifting, I competed in CrossFit a bit and some jiu-jitsu for a while. And the thing that I loved about those sports when I was doing them was that for that moment when you were doing that explosive movement or that high intensity sport, the inner voice was shut off. And so you could sort of silence silence the demons for a little while. And it was a way to escape from that inner voice. And so what I'm curious about is that the world that we experience around us, how much of it is completely dependent on our inner voice telling us what's happening or where we're at or something like that? How much does it play into our either ability to enjoy the world around us or look at it as a thing that we dread being in?
Yeah, so there's lots of things that we can say about that. Not every adult human has an inner voice. Some people never had an inner voice. They don't hear themselves talk to themselves. Children, you know, you can track the ontogeny of this in the young children. The young children, particularly if they're prelinguistic, you know, they don't have an inner voice. And of course, pointed out that under certain conditions, you can lose it. So I'm still stuck at your first stage. I love long distance running, biking, rowing, climbing big walls. And there you can get into the state of flow, right? And the state of flow that you achieve in these power sports, a state of flow is precisely defined by the absence. You're fully in the here and now. And that voice, that critic that always tells you you're too fast, or you're too slow, or you're not pushing yourself hard enough or whatever, that voice is gone. And it feels, I mean, that's why I think some of these sports are very addicted, because it's so wonderful to just be in the here and now. And of course, during psychedelics, right? If you take a high dose psychedelics, you can certainly experience a loss of self. But self-consciousness, I mean, that's what we're talking about, is, of course, only one particular aspect of consciousness. Right now, I'm seeing the picture of you on my screen, okay? That doesn't have to involve me at all, right? Or when you have pure pain, when you have this god-awful, this is one of my trigger moments that really made me think about consciousness and its neural basis, you have this god-awful tooth that's inflamed, this pounding away, it's filling your entire consciousness, right? Your entire consciousness is reduced to this god-awful pain. Well, again, there isn't really too much of high-level voice there. It's just god-awful, right? And so we adult, particularly literally humans, tend often to reify the self, which comes at a cost, because the self can also be belittling, right? You think you're inadequate. Nothing really measures up to your inner voice, to your standard. Or in certain politicians whose name we shouldn't mention, you know, who are overly obsessed with their self. It's all about their ego. It's all about the self. So the self is a late stage evolutionary adaptation. It's necessary for us to do long-term planning, get your PhD, trained for things, but it can also be a burden to bear. And that's why, you know, people do meditate, people try to go into the flow, or people try to experience loss of self in psychedelics.
Huh. So that brings up a lot of questions that even some of them that were previously written down. And one of the things that some of the listeners were interested in, and as was I too, is you were talking about that inner critic. And I'm wondering, with the advent of social media, for example, there's always, we're bombarded with more comparison than we ever have. And not only that, but comparison to things that may not even be real. You can create this fake world within social media that some people are doing better than they are. They're always out on these lavish vacations, and maybe it's just a staged thing. And by doing that, it's certainly driven in. There's many studies that have shown the rates of anxiety and depression and things have correlated a bit well with social media. But by the same token, though, someone that is in a bad state of mind might see some things that are motivating and it can turn them around. But when it comes to us as a species, the idea of introducing this social media happened very fast. I mean, it was within a couple of years, suddenly there's this bombardment of the stimuli that maybe we haven't experienced to that same intensity. How do you think that has shaped a lot of the health, like the mental health or that inner voice of people now, and especially going forward as we adapt as a species?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, rising rates of anxiety and depression now up to 35% or 40% of freshmen or sophomore undergrads, qualify as being highly anxious or generalized anxiety disorders. Yeah, because of exactly the reason you mentioned. And of course, the disregard more and more of the physical world. A lot of these young people, we study this in the foundation I lead, the Tiny Blue Dot Foundation, studies and funds research that people simply disregard. They don't even have a lot of they don't know what to do with their interoceptive experiences because they're always oriented towards their phone, which, as you point out, all takes place in the social place. he likes me or he doesn't like me, or I get these likes, or look at what that person over there says. And of course, we all know it drives towards the extreme and polarization. However, this crisis in anxiety predates social media. It's been ongoing roughly for 70 years, post-World War II. And it coincides with the loss of autonomy. So today you have helicopter parenting. Are you a parent?
No, I'm not.
Okay, helicopter parenting, where every single moment of a child is supervised by an adult. Lack of, you know, I grew up, maybe you also, where my mom sent me outside and she says, be back by 6 in time for dinner. Right. And then I was on my own with my brother and my friends. Today, that's simply unthinkable. Right. Oh, my, you did what to your child? In fact, you can get arrested today. Right. We have passed laws that if you see a 10-year-old going to the store by themselves, you as parent can be arrested. Right. So there is this loss of autonomy. So there are multiple reasons why anxiety is rising. Social media plays a very big role, and I can only ask people to minimize the role that it plays in their life until the children have established a robust inner self. I mean, of course, it's a part of our world, but you want to delay the introduction to social media as long as you can, certainly into puberty, so they have developed this some sense of self before they encounter, yes, this fake world on social media where everything is extreme, either extremely beautiful, extremely ugly, and opinions are highly polarized.
So with developing the inner self, I mean, I imagine perhaps that the stronger that the inner self is, the less influenced it might be by those external factors that are creating that comparison. But for individuals that do struggle with that strong inner self, is there a way past that developmental stage that mindset can be shifted? Is it plastic enough that it can be trained past that developmental point?
Yeah. So you have therapy. I mean, this is what therapy does, right? So let's say you constantly catastrophize, you constantly belittle yourself, you constantly feel yourself inadequate, right? Everyone judges you, you think, you believe, everyone judges you, etc. So you live in this very, what we call perception box. You live in this very narrow perception box. Yes, you can change that. Classical ways you change it by therapy. Okay, this takes a long time, you know, its outcomes uncertain. So that's one way. Other ways are you learn about the world. You become much more self-aware in terms of, your body. You do yoga, you do mindfulness. This is why so many people go to meditation or meditation app. You can have transformative experiences, right? You can have an experience either spontaneous, and people, of course, have had this and described these for the last several millennia, as long as there have been people around, where suddenly, so what's a transformative experience? William James, the father of American psychology and philosophy, talks about them in his 1902 book, The Variety of Religious Experiences. So you can have a spontaneous realization that's involuntarily, it happens to you, you can't sort of wish it upon, where suddenly you look at the world in very different ways after this experience. You say, oh my God, it's a choice. I don't have to be depressed. Yes, this bad stuff happened to me, but I can be active, you know, a captain of my own soul. I can change the world for the better. I can change myself. Where people have a distinct before and afterwards, this can be classical religious conversion experience. It can be an aesthetic experience. It can be near-death experience. It can be a psychedelic-induced experiences. So there are ways, and you can try to facilitate these or make them happen with maybe enhanced probability, these transformative experiences for therapeutic benefit. And in fact, trials for psilocybin for treatment-resistant depression or major depressive disorders have shown that therapeutic efficiency scales directly with the probability of people reporting what's called a mystical experience, which is one subset of transformative experiences. So things can change. Yes.
So there is hope. You know, one of the things that I find joy in is, you know, we can see the enrollment for some of the clinical trials that happen here. And, you know, some of the clinical trials that involve exercise over time, it takes a little while to get the participants, but then there's the studies that have the use of psychedelics and, you know, with the student base as Chuck the population.
In Madison.
Yeah, I have the subjects, the you know, they fill up the subjects pretty fast on those with the students.
He
which
said,
is
typically within a day, you put out enough, and the next day you have way oversubscribed.
Yeah, so it's always, you know, I did some exercise studies in undergrad, and we had such a tough time getting people to come in and exercise. So I just said that we needed to put some mushrooms in there, and then we would have had it instant.
Well, of course, exercise, we know it's a traditional. I mean, it turns out many wisdom traditions, right? Going back in all different cultures, know this already. You can change, you know, you can be a stoic. We know exercise is really good for you, right? And also for your mental health being, right? And for your development, exercise is critical. Schools cut back on PE, right? There's less and less PE. Well, that's, you know, at the expense of computer programming or some other skill that now open, you know, that ChatGPT can do much better anyhow. So we there is a lot of knowledge we have about how to change your mind. We just have to, you know, cultivate good habits and actually do it.
Yeah. So the question I had on that, so you talked about having that mystical experience for some individuals, or sort of that aha moment, that wake up call, that suddenly your perception of the world around you flips and you no longer see the things that you see the same way that you did before. And the thing that it brings it back to, at least personally for me, so I lost like 150 pounds and, you know, I've kept it off for 15, 16 years now. So I was like 30 pounds and I lost a ton, and I've kept it off for up until now, you know. So that happened when I was like 19, something like that.
Wait, you were a runner and
no.
Well, with 330 pounds?
No, that happened after I lost the weight. It turns out that if you start training when you're, you know, 330 pounds, that when you take that backpack off, it, you know, the running doesn't seem so bad anymore. And so I just kept going, you know. A lot of times I've been asked personally, what was that moment that switched the way that you thought about food or healthy habits or things like that? And I never really had a good answer. The only thing that I could think of was that there was this one moment, you know, I was in my bedroom after high school, in between college, and I just, you know, I looked in the mirror and I thought, what am I doing? I'm compensating for anxiety or anything like that with food. And that's not really helping. It's just making the problem worse. And it was a complete 180 flip. And I don't remember what the actual trigger was, but I do clearly remember standing in the room that one day and everything just all of a sudden culminated together. And suddenly my whole perception of health, fitness, of life changed. And you've mentioned that there's certain facilitatory agents that people have a higher probability of having those type of moments, whether it be psychedelics or you know, exercise or things like that. And I guess seeing from the neuroscience realm, there's this idea of like psychedelics, for example, or exogenous agents that have been used in many clinical trials, and you've seen benefits for those that have had that mind-altering experience forever. And then on the flip side, there's always that inherent risk that comes with them, that maybe that experience leads to a negative flip on the mindset. And so it may not always be a transformative experience in the positive realm. Is there anything that has been shown or any evidence to suggest that there are ways in order to tailor those experiences that the transformations are in a positive light, so that way there can be a mitigation of any risk of it having a negative annotation with it?
Okay, so two things. So A, I think these sorts of experience that you just told me, yesterday, incidentally, I was talking to a prisoner who's now out of prison. And he told me he, one day, of course, a prison is a highly controlled environment. He was in a cell with one other person locked up for weeks during COVID. And one day he had this stoic realization that, oh, the only thing I can truly control is my reaction to what's happening around me. And he said this simple insight from one day to the next changed everything for him. And said, starting the next day, he felt much more content. So we do, I think many people have had this. Typically, when you're younger, when your brain is more malleable, and when it's easier to change the narrative. But the older the you get, we know the less plasticity your brain has. The more it's just a set of habits. We don't know what triggers these. You know, in normal conditions, I think they're much more common than we think. Our culture doesn't have a way. So I've talked now because I give public talks about it, where people tell me, regular people, they had a religious conversion experience, or one had an experience in the ICU. Well, I mean, while she was bleeding in the ICU. I think it's more common than we think it is. We don't know what triggers it. Now, if we talk specifically about psychedelics, where we know a little bit more, that's more likely. Particularly if you take a high dose, that you can have a loss of ego, but that not all, you know, we may know this from personal experience, not every trip has that. And even if you lose your ego, that doesn't guarantee that you have a transformative experiences. And as you implied, yes, sometimes the trip can be negative, but you know, you can have a bad trip. But actually, experience shows, if you ask people, even the bad trip in hindsight may have beneficial benefits. And certainly during clinical trials, it is very rare to have serious adverse side effects where people have, let's say, prolonged hallucinatory disorder. But it can happen. And you may have heard about the story of the Air Alaska pilot 2 years ago, who tripped for the first time in his life several days before he flew at the wake of his best friend. And then he was off duty. He asked his Alaska airline colleagues whether he could fly in the jump seat between Seattle and I think either Oregon or SFO. And they agreed to it because he was a pilot in good standing. And then during the mid portion of the flight, he stood up and said, "I feel bad," and tried to shut off. The two ceiling switches clearly marked that shut off the engines, both engines, which, you know, could have killed everyone on board. And it turned out he was in this what's called derealization or depersonalization state that lasted, in his case, for several days, even afterwards when he was already in prison for what he did. So that can happen, but that's pretty rare. But it is a risk. But in clinical trials, now, of course, clinical trials, people are, you know, very selective, right? Typically, clinical trials, the drawback of a clinical trial is because you have a long list of exclusion criteria, it's typically not the population that actually would use it in real life, right? Because real life people have multiple trauma, particularly if you're talking about, you know, psychiatric symptoms, they overlap. You get people with all sorts of experiences, et cetera, and not the healthy, young, you know, no other mental disorders, clinical population. But in clinical trials, it's extremely rare for there to be serious side effects.
Interesting. So one of the things that you had mentioned, though, was that the individuals that are typically taking it out on the street are not, you know, necessarily the ones in the clinical trials. And that's something that we deal with in the world. We study opioids in the lab. And so when you're talking about an opioid overdose, you know, when we have clean fentanyl in the lab that we're giving to a inbred mouse strain and studying this one particular effect, we get pretty consistent effects and we know how to reverse it and we can find out. But when you talk about the use of illicit opiates out in the streets, it's fentanyl mixed with xylazine or with ketamine or something else that you don't know, plus the longstanding history of where they are. Maybe they haven't eaten in a few days, or maybe it's, you know, so it's a totally different experience to the drug. And, you know, so one of the things that came to mind as you were talking about that, one of the things that sparked my curiosity is the idea of projecting our own feelings onto others in order to understand or rationalize that, you know, we've had, let's say in the lab, or let's say from personal use of psychedelics or anything that has had this positive transformational type of state, it's easy to say, okay, this is something that had a very positive experience for me. And I think for you, it would have the same positive experience. And so here, you know, we should try it and see how that works. And thankfully, oftentimes that is the case for the individual. But on that topic of, let's say, empathy or empathizing or trying to understand the way that someone else is feeling, so that way you can connect with that person. When it comes to consciousness itself, is there a benefit of being able to try to internalize someone else's emotions in order to make us try to feel the way that they feel, to perhaps experience some of their consciousness within us?
Well, if people don't do that, if children don't develop that, so for instance, in autism or extreme case of autism, where the patient has no theory of mind. So in other words, it's useful to do what's called mind reading. Why? Because then that lets me understand why you behave the way you do with respect to me, right? In fact, we can see this in great apes and chimps and other gorillas. They have already, you know, a beginning of theory of mind where they know, well, I know the intention of that particular ape, right? So trying to infer, so it's extremely important to be able to infer the why you say the things you do or do the things you do, right? And so my ability to read your mind indirectly, of course, it's not direct mind reading, but indirectly mind reading is a critical ability to function in society. And individuals who have trouble with that will typically have, you know, problems living in society.
Yeah. So is the ability to do that, do you know if that has evolved with the size of the community that the species has created?
Yeah, in fact,
created?
There's what they call Dunbar's number, right? This anthropologist who says, who claims that brain size is directly related to the effective group size that that particular species hangs out with. So for us, I think Dunbar numbers is like 100. And so the argument is you can really know and interact well with about 170 or 100 people. If it's much larger, you know, the intensity and your ability to read and understand them falls off. And that scales with all sorts of things like the optimal size of an army unit, et cetera, for maximal group and group cohesion. Yeah, I mean, so that's a well-trodden road in anthropology and evolutionary biology relating group size of that particular species to brain size. And so where we, of course, excel, Homo sapiens, is reading other people's mind and developing what you call the sense of empathy. Empathy is trying, feeling for you. I not only realize that you're in pain because I can see you moaning and I can see you, you know, your pupils dilate and all of that, then I begin to feel with you, for you, right? Empathy, compassion.
Yeah. And so it's always kind of fascinated me about that. So I teach a class here on pain, but it's mechanisms and management of pain in veterinary medicine. And so in the vet school here, I'll teach that course on pain. And it's always interesting because pain itself, you know, is a perception. And so you can stimulate these pain fibers all you want, but it doesn't correlate linearly with the experience of pain whatsoever, because it's very much modulated. And then you take it one step further, and now you're trying to diagnose and treat a dog or a cat or even a turtle or something like that that has not only not the you know, it doesn't even express pain to us in a way that we may even comprehend. You know, if you have a snake that's in pain, what do you look at for showing painful signs? It's not like it's sweating or shaking or anything like that. And so it brings up, you know, sort of the idea of when we're trying to experience something that someone else is experiencing in order to understand it, just to baseline, try to understand the world around us, that's one of the ways that it seems like we do that. And there's certainly error that occurs within the process that can create some, you know, I think this person hates me because they have a very stoic face to them. And when in reality, they're thinking more about the fact that they ate something weird for breakfast. And so maybe taking a step back and not assuming what other people are thinking. You know, we've heard the saying a lot that I like, that assuming is making an ass of you and me, you know, which is just a play on the letters of them. but with that idea of, using the ability to understand, trying to understand what someone else is feeling by projecting that experience into ourselves and to see how we would react to that experience, and then looking for an error with how they respond to see whether it's rational or not. It brings up a topic that's been interesting in my mind, at least when I was hoping to ask you about, was the mirror neuron theory, or, you know, I would say the mirror neuron system, but I'm not sure there's been a discrete population of neurons that has been ascribed to it. But, you know, the idea that if I'm watching a soccer game, for example, intrinsically, there's a part of me that feels as though I'm playing the game, and this, my ability to then play soccer afterwards is even minusculely, but still better than it was if I hadn't watched it to begin with. And so I'm wondering, from a mindset type of standpoint, do you think that there is this hardwired system in us that allows us to try to align the conscious experience within a population? And what would be the benefit of that?
Well, I wouldn't call it hardwired because it's so amazing flexible. Yeah, but the propensity to be able to represent what you are thinking, I think that's sort of part of our evolutionary heritage. Well, because it's so enormously used, it has to be flexible because, you know, cultures are very, very different. The way they behave and what's tolerated and what's acceptable in-group, out-group changes so much across culture. It can't be hardwired. It has to be flexible. But of course, it's enormously successful. And again, we see this in politics where certain individuals are just extraordinarily successful at modulating or getting other people to do their will for good and evil, right? Because they have some sort of insight into what moves people, not necessarily rationally, but what gets people upset or what pleases people. And so, and we all need this skill to a certain extent, right? If you're reporting if you have a boss, you need to understand what's going to make your boss happy or unhappy about the way you perform. If you're in a relationship with someone, you have to understand how they feel, how they truly feel and what they like, and what they dislike. If you raise children, you have to do it. If you're living with a pet, you have to do it. So it's a basic property of living in a society that is that's non-solitary. If you're a hermit, you know, you don't need it. But most of us aren't hermits. And so, yes, we need it. And the people who don't have it or only have limited ability, they end up having problems.
So that kind of brings me to my next question that I was going to ask is about community, about your personal community or about your experience to different diverse cultures or things like that. When you start to scale it, do you see with let's say individuals that have had a very small community that they've stayed within, not a very diverse experience pool that they've had, you know, when they looking at how something stressful may affect them or how they might view a certain event, there's perhaps a limited subset of things that they can draw on in order to determine what might be the reaction to that. On the same token, on the flip side, you know, do you see as the size of the community or the size of the or the number of different experiences that person has had with different cultures or something, for example, scale out to be better suited to try to understand some of the behaviors going on in the world?
Well, I mean, we do know if you look at smaller, more restrictive community, take the Amish, right? So people have studied the mental health of Amish. It's difficult because there are all sorts of factors that you know, one has to take into consideration. But most people agree that their mental health is much better than the mental health of people in the same county, but who are part of sort of modern American life, right? They typically have a much smaller community. They have many fewer people they relate with day to day, but do it at a much more intense manner. And their health and their mental health in general seems to be much better, with lower reported incidence of anxiety and depression, etc. We live now in very large communities, these semi-anonymous communities constituted by social media that aren't geographic-based anymore. But of course, you can have 10,000 friends, but you know, if the shit hits the fan, who's actually going to come by in the evening and look, you know, and sit down with you and talk to you? Is it going to be one of your 10,000 Facebook friends, or is it going to be, you know, someone who lives close by with whom you really have developed an intimate relationship with? So I don't know how it scales. But I don't know. And very large modern societies, we still need, I mean, you know, if you don't have some true friends, I don't think these large social media following are going to add anything to your happiness.
It just is using those, the temporary distraction.
Yes, it hacks into those mechanisms for monetary gains of Facebook and, you know, the other people who do that, but it may not be for your benefit at all. Although, as you pointed out earlier, it may benefit some who might otherwise be. I mean, social media is clearly has benefits. Otherwise, people wouldn't do it and may be good for some people. But the way most people use it today, I mean, you know, if you fly, I fly a lot. I can see it. Some people for the entire duration of a 4 hour, 6 hours or transatlantic flight, as long as they have internet, they're just on their phone going from one Snapchat video to the next. And you wonder, what does that do to their brain and to their mind? And I'm pretty sure it's not good. It's not positive for them.
No, and I even notice in myself, if I'm using social media more in a day or in a week, I just notice I feel a little bit more tense or a little bit more anxious. And you always feel like you're sort of missing out on something because suddenly you're seeing some hedge fund billionaire telling you that you're missing out on a stock. And then you flip it over and it says you need to be a stoic wolf in the woods. And you're just always at this sort of duality of what you should be. But when in reality, maybe you should just be yourself. Yes. and not be influenced
in the
by
world,
these things.
In the physical world.
Mind, right. Just physical. Taking things for what they are. But you know, the idea though is that it gives that quick sort of distraction from the world. It gives a quick hit of whatever our reward centers might be. You know, maybe I flip on a video and I see this goat doing a trick and I think, oh wow, that makes me, you know, feel kind of happy. And then I flip over. But, you know, in reality, my attention span between those videos has only been, you know, at max 5 to 10 seconds. And I was experimenting with some reels a couple of years ago when I was just curious as to, you know, what draws people's attention. And I made some reels on Instagram to see what was taking. And it was fascinating to see that, you know, if you had a static image for more than 1 or 1.5 seconds, the fall off was incredible. So you always had to just be flashing things one video to the next. And even if I was trying to get a science, you know, lesson across, I had to just flash random pictures of dogs and things that didn't even have anything to do with it, but it sort of momentarily distracted and it kept them on that video of what it was that I was saying. And it was fascinating to see how short the attention spans have gotten. And for people that are now learning, for example, being able to stay attended, you know, and I know there's sort of this relationship between consciousness and attention on something or your conscious experience of it. That's why I bring it up. And I'm curious from your side, from the consciousness side, what is the effect of not having the same attention span that we did before? Are we not able to take in things to the same extent that we were prior with the attention spans going down?
Well, in some sense, you take in more because each image is a new piece of information, right? When you flash those dogs and cats images, each one is new. So you optimize just the sheer sort of mutual information between the external world and your brain. But it's trivial in a sense because there's nothing truly meaningful there. Just accept a series of 10,000 different cats and dogs images, right? And or videos of cats and dogs, and you can stare at them endlessly. What it feels to do is to really engage truly with a work of art or with the world. Like, and we know this, again, survey have shown this, the ability of young, of undergrads to seriously, to read, let's say, Dostoevsky, you know, or Tolstoy, Anna Karina, or a piece of, you know, to actually read Plato or, you know, some of the foundational canon in any literature is shrinking because people want an AI summary. They want a brief summary. So, okay, I get it. I've read Plato because, you know, I've got the AI a summary. So what it means, it engaging ever shallow with the world, you get this illusion of knowing a lot, but what you truly, so you get huge amount of information and very little wisdom. very little true insight into the world. So AI, on average, is going to make us dumber. There's no question about it. We'll be more effective, maybe in some sense, but we'll certainly be dumber as individual. No question about it.
Well, that's you went exactly where I was hoping that you would go into the AI thing, because when you bring up that, you know, when you do an AI summary of something, it gives you the spark notes pretty well, or, you know, it'll even say the TLDR, the too long didn't read aspect, which blows my mind that you can get a short summary and even that is too long didn't read and it'll just give you bullet points. But even in our academic work, for example, you can see that you can take an entire paper, you can push it in there and it'll give you within a paragraph what they were testing, how they tested it, and what the results were and what it means instantly. But you don't get any of the backstory that happened at all with it.
It's just reading, you know, it's essentially like reading abstracts of books, and your life will just be one series of abstract after the other. Yeah. How much is that going to stick? Do you really think, you know, getting a, you know, Anna Karen and a piece in War and Peace by Tolstoy, do you think reading an abstract is really going to stick and move you as much as actually reading the book? No. But of course, people want, you know, action. Or I don't have time to read this. And in fact, we know book sales have fallen off precipitously. Most people, again, if you look at it in the airplane, when I started flying 40 years ago, lots of people were reading book. These days, it's extremely rare for people to have a Kindle or a regular book. But most of them are on their social media feed.
And I even see it from the students here that, you know, you give an essay question and you can certainly tell the use of AI. But not only the use of AI, because I think, you know, it is a tool and it's here and like it or not, I mean, being able to leverage it is going to be something that you may get passed up by someone that utilizes it faster than you did. But what I noticed the big thing is like you said, it doesn't seem to have the depth, at least as of right now. And I think not only does it not have the capacity for depth is there. Like if you push it long enough, you can get a pretty high level description of something. But I think the brevity of the answers have taken away from the comprehensiveness of whatever topic it is that's being explained.
Also, I mean, whether you are you just concerned with the momentary uptake of information, or do you also want that information to be retained, right? And the way we, you know, biological creatures like us retain information by having it impressed again and again. And so that's why you read any book or textbook, because, you know, it may present the same idea in very different ways, right? And you have to do exercises and homework. Why? Because again, doing the homework, you know, if you think about physics or standard neurophysiology textbook, right? Or doing Hodgkin-Huxley, et cetera, right? That helps you better understand the equation, for instance, if we're talking about equation, and helps you understand the logic behind it. And just getting us a brief summary, yeah, I've seen it, then out of sight, out of mind, next thing, and next thing, right? It just leads to a very shallow thinking. It may be more efficient overall for the system, but it leads just to very shallow thinking. And this will show up now and will be worse in 5 years and 10 years and 15 years from now. And one shudders to think where we'll be in 20 years or 50 years from now.
Yeah, completely dependent on, you know, on the flip side. What I'm wondering though is that, let's say, you know, when we talked about the conscious experience being a subjective experience of the world and how you view the world, maybe there's similar stimuli, but we may not have the same experience of whatever those stimuli is. And, you know, one of the questions that I even had written down was, we both look at something red, and when we both call it red, and you know, there's an image that we both see, and it certainly has the properties of light that we can measure, the same wavelength of light that's being delivered to our eyes to give us that same stimulus. But whether or not what I actually see as red may not be the same thing that you actually see as red, we've just both agreed that what we experience when we look at this stimulus is the same. And I had a question about, is there ever going to be a way that we can project our inner consciousness in so that we can compare how close our actual experiences are, was the original question. But in terms of AI, What I have noticed though is that, and so when I started in Seattle, I had to learn patch clamping. I was working with goats and we were doing breathing in goats. And then suddenly I was given a neonatal mouse brain and told to patch clamp some neurons. And so that was a big change initially. And Nino had given me the book that you may have be familiar with. Like, I think it's in my office here, The Ionic Channels of Excitable Membranes by Bertie Hill.
Yeah. Who used to be a faculty here at UW.
Yeah. And for someone that didn't have an experience with physics or calculus, it was a heavy read to say the least. But you know, let's say that something like that has been pushed upon me and I need to understand and synthesize this, but maybe I didn't have the background. I didn't have the physics background to just dive right in. But, you know, with, let's say, an AI tool that's able to reframe a subject in a way that aligns a little bit more with our background in order to tailor it then towards the physics. Okay, maybe you don't understand the math, but here's what it means first. Is there a benefit maybe in doing that, even though, you know, the flip side is that there's certainly the lack of depth that can come with it.
Yeah,
as
there's
well.
No question. Look, I mean, I use AI in there, I mean, day to day for all sorts of reasons, including doing math. There's no question there's a benefit there. But there, we tend to emphasize those, and that's why AI is being developed. But what we never or rarely talk about are the big costs, particularly the cost of young people who've never encountered, who sort of haven't been raised sort of without it, and just the cost of depending ever more on it, and what will that do to our thinking and to our ability to understand the world. But, you know, here we are, it's, you know, they're part of our world, and they'll be, and in fact, we're all racing, you know, both. Every company is racing towards building ever more powerful, you know, AGI in the limits. Whether that's a good thing or not for Homo sapiens, I'm very skeptical. But they're two powerful tools, no question about it.
Yeah. So going back to the idea of projecting, you know, the consciousness of to be able to see what it is that Christoph sees in the world. You know, we both are looking at an apple, and I assume that we both see the same stimulus, but whether it's registering the same.
Well, the dress is a spectacular example of that, right? You know, hashtag the dress.
Oh, the blue and
so,
gold or
you know,
black.
This wedding dress that went viral, the picture, this spontaneous picture of a wedding dress in 2015 in Scotland that went viral, where roughly you can get it, just hashtag the dress. Where roughly half of humanity sees it blue and black, and the other half roughly sees it as white and gold. And it's not like one of these bistable perception, like, you know, a young girl, old woman, which flips back and forth. This people see stable, either white, like I see it, white and gold. There's no ambiguity about it. I open my eyes and I see it just as white and gold. That's end of story. While other people see it as blue and black. And as you point out, the same photons coming in at the same wavelengths into you and my eyes, but then because the brain does different processing, because we have different brightness assumption, that's why that's the nature of this particular illusion. Your brain computes something different than my brain, and so you perceive it different from the way I do. Now, in general perception, in sensory perception, that's actually pretty rare. That's why this went viral, because, you know, typically, unless you're colorblind or blind, you know, we can all agree. I mean, what do you see there?
It's a mug that says I heart.
Yeah. And so most of the time, I would say among able, you know, people who have normal sensory apparatuses, that we tend to see or hear or smell something that's similar, not identical. Because we all have different receptor, we have different receptor mutations, etc. But then when it comes to political context, like if I tell you what happened on October 7th in Israel, or what happened in January 6th in Washington, D.C., or who won the 2020 election, right? Suddenly the social political constructed facts, not sort of more sensory facts, can take on profound different meaning on your experience of the world and your priors, right? So yes, we all perceive, and I mean, this goes back to, you can read Immanuel Kant, Transcendent Idealism. You know, in order for us to experience anything, our mind needs certain assumptions, like everything has a location in space. Everything has to occur at a particular point in time. In time, everything is caused by something, causality, right? He calls those categories. And again, under certain types of experiences like 5-MeO-DMT or near-death experience, those categories can be annihilated. So there may not be space anymore. All you see is a single point of bright light, or time has come. There is no more passage, perceived passage of time. Right, you are in the eternal now. The moment isn't too long or too brief or too short. It simply is. When those categories can disappear, but you are still conscious. So that just shows us all these things are construct of the mind, and we may construct them in slightly different ways.
So with that, you know, the idea that we can create our own perceptions of the world. One of the things that I had,
we do it all the time. This is the nature of the universe we are thrown into. We construct, we actively construct this perception of my view of reality. And usually it coincides with your view of reality. But it may not coincide with a view of a person who's totally blind or who is deaf or who's on psychedelic or who's psychotic or with a baby or with a dog or with the perceptual view of a snake.
So is there a way that we have to, you know, we have our perception of something, let's say how we interpret a certain event. Is there like an error comparison with how, I don't even know how to explain it. I guess the thing that comes to mind with this is when we talk about dreaming, you know, dreaming, you feel as though you're experiencing these events that happen in your dreams, and maybe from the neural perspective, you are. And, you know, one of the funny things that comes up with some couples sometimes is you have a dream of your partner cheating on you in the middle of the night, right? And you wake up and you feel angry or you feel distant towards them because there was that experience of them cheating within the dream. And, you know, you as a partner turn over and go,
with you and your partner. I've never had that.
Well, maybe that's maybe that's a Wisconsin thing that pops up, you know, the old farmer adage
But Nick, interesting, that only occurs once you're awake and you think right about it. Inside the dream, it's as real as life itself, right?
Right. And I'm, you know, in the dream, you may notice you didn't have the emotions necessarily in the dream, but it's when you wake up, you remember, oh, you know, that made me angry or sad or something like that. And so with the advent of technology and studies and everything going forward, you know, we look at the Matrix movie. One of the things that was appealing is they could just upload this series of experiences into the brain, and suddenly you had those memories, those experiences that you could draw upon. You know, do you think going forward that would have benefit to study a way in which you could, I guess, implant or imprint experiences?
Yeah, I mean, this sort of the standard view, you know, the predictive coding view, right? The predictive processing, that our brains are very good at predicting things. They're prediction engines. We do that constantly. Whether I'm reaching out to something, I expect the cup to be there where I last put it. Or when I say something, I expect you to roughly say something, you know, that's compatible with that. And yeah, I'm surprised. And we know that neurons that signal deviation from those predictions. And you know, this is where dopamine involved, actually not an actual reward, but in signaling deviation from an expected reward, either positive or negative, right? That's how dopamine release gets triggered. Yeah, but those they may be inactive during dreams because you're never surprised that you can fly. You're never surprised that you encounter someone who's long dead, right? Or a beloved pet of your childhood that you lost, right? Or that you walk through walls. It's only afterwards that you wake up that you say, that couldn't have been. That must have been a dream. Same thing in psychedelic experience. You can literally encounter heaven and hell and God and demons. And that's just the way it is. And it's only afterwards when you reflect upon it. And in fact, the other thing is particularly during psychedelic experience, it also goes the other way. When you have experiences where you feel this is it, you've just come to the beating heart of the universe. You're truly at home now. This is really what the universe is like. And then you come back to regular life and you say that there's something missing here. I know what it's like. I've been there. I've seen it. But this is not it. So it can go both ways. Extremely interesting experience. Yeah, so I think ultimately that taps into neural circuits that try to drive this error between what you expect and what you actually encounter to try to minimize that.
You know, I've never thought about the fact that in my dreams, if I experienced myself flying, I never really questioned it. It was just,
well, because
here I am.
Mainly you don't have a sense of self, right? You are not the director of your dream. I mean, except if you have this very special class of dreams called lucid dreaming, right? So lucid dreaming are characterized by the fact that you are some sort of awakened. You can, to a certain extent, control your dream. Dream, typically, there's reduced self. And this goes hand in hand when people do imaging with reduction in sort of default mode activity, reduction in activity in posterior cingulate, where a lot of the notion of self are actually instantiated. Yeah, you don't have sense of self in your dreams.
Interesting. I'll be curious to see as virtual reality expands. That's sort of a way that you can simulate a bit of you can drive where the person's at least visual experience is going, but they still have that sense of self if they're awake when they're doing
Yes, but with powerful, so I'm thinking of this guy, David Glowacki, with his beautiful Nature paper a couple of years ago, where he uses molecular biology dynamics software to visualize, and also with music and a voiceover, what happens during death. So it's a therapy. So he had a near-death experience, and then he developed this partly also to help people who are stage 4 cancer and will dying deal with the death anxiety, where you can visualize. I've done it several times now. It's really amazing. It's akin to a psychedelic experience, but in a totally sober state, just with, having these VR goggles, where sort of you lose the sense of self. You become identical with a group if you're doing it as a group. And then you exhale sort of your spirit into, I mean, this is what it's suggested by the VR interaction. At the end of this, you literally die. It's very mesmerizing, completely transcendent.
Wow.
They call the pneumadelic.
A pneumadelic.
You can just Google pneumadelics.
Yeah. It would be fascinating if there was a way, you've experienced your death a few times then in order to compare it to what real death is. But unfortunately, there wouldn't be unless you had a near death experience, for example, then perhaps you could compare it to that.
Well, yeah. There are a few recordings of people dying with a high density EEG montage in the clinic. Yeah, but of course, your death depends on your circumstances. Most people die when they're heavy under sedation these days, right? Under opioids or other pain medication. There used to be, before this was widespread, people had what's called terminal lucidity. You can read it up. It's a well-known phenomena where people seemingly, let's say, late-stage dementia or something, or they've had this high fever and delirium. Towards the end, their mind seems to clear. They become conscious of their surroundings. They can then maybe talk normally and, for an hour or two, and they believe, oh, it's wonderful, I've recovered. But typically that means they will pass, that night or something.
You know, I've never thought of using the sedatives in a patient's last days, taking that experience away from them if it is a beautiful death type of experience.
Yes, it certainly will. In fact, it's less frequently reported, this terminal lucidity. And certainly if you believe that you will have an NDE, a near-death experience, yeah, if your brain is on opioids, then you're much less likely, because then sort of you're just in this, state where you're barely aware, and at some point, you go lower and lower, and then the switch is finally turned off, but you have no experience. And of course, sooner or later, will all of us encounter this particular transition?
Sure, sure. We'll all eventually succumb to the death. So in the last few minutes, I just wanted to ask, because what I like about and what I love about the work that you're doing is that it's very bridging of this neuroscience, this mechanistic neuroscience of understanding how these neural circuits create this philosophical experience that we all have. And a lot of mechanistic neuroscience doesn't try to bridge that big of a gap. And I think by just trying to address that gap, the findings along the way are larger than they would be if you're trying to tackle just a small problem at once. And so in your view, going forward with the neuroscience community or with the neuroscience experiments and things that are happening, where do you see either neurotechnology or neuroscience research from either a philosophical or a neurophysiology side going in the next few years, you know, 5, 10, 15 years? And do you think that there is going to be a point at which, and we didn't even get a chance to get into too depth into quantifying the actual physical constituents of consciousness itself, but I know there was a famous bet that you had going on at one point of where we would be and where we are now. So going forward, where do you think the progress is going to be in this field?
Causal manipulation of conscious states in animals and in people. You know, for the longest, particularly in people, for obvious reasons, we've just doing this observational study. So you put someone in the magnet while they see, let's say, the dress, right? Or, you know, some other stimulus, some sounds or sights or touches, and then you observe the brain. This is sort of what 90% of cognitive neuroscience is. That's all fine, but ultimately we want to study we're interested in, most of us at least, in the causal mechanism, right? What actually drives things. And there our techniques are getting better, whether that's, particularly with TMS or temporal interference technology, and with people growing ability to record from the human brain. Optogenetics probably is less relevant for the human brain, right? Because the obvious risks, with a few exceptions like things in the eye. So that's, I think, to me, the greatest excitement, neurotechnology that can now make the transition through the valley of death from, doing things in mice or goats or monkeys to the ability to manipulate and understand the human brain.
So the focus on translation, I like that you used valley of death. When I did my PhD in physiology, I did a secondary PhD alongside it in clinical and translational science. And the theory of the valley of death is always a big one that we had focused on of bench to bedside.
You have two PhDs?
Yes. Huh. Yep. Well, yeah, the dissertation was just a little bit longer, so some of the classes overlapped. But anyways, yeah. So Christoph, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show. We'll make sure we get you here out on time. Your insights into the field have not been anything but massive, and I know myself as a neuroscientist, I've looked up to a lot of your work. Being out in Seattle, I've played mini golf in the downstairs of the Allen Institute many times.
Oh yeah,
so I was aware of the work that you guys have been doing, and it definitely drove a lot of the science that we had to look outside of the autonomic circuits and to take some of these bigger conceptual ideas and to start to weave them into my science. So like it or not, your influence even on my studies is well known. So thank you again for taking the time.
All right. Thank you for having me, Nick.